It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The state is opening up vaccine appointments to people in Phase 1B today, with a plan to begin scheduling all Pennsylvanians starting April 19th. WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden has been following the vaccine rollout. Sarah, at this point, how many doses of vaccine have been distributed?
Well, when it comes to doses, about 5.5 million have been distributed, and this includes first and second shots along with the one-and-done Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That all shakes out to maybe like 1.7 million Pennsylvanians being partially vaccinated and another 2 million people being fully vaccinated. Roughly a third of Pennsylvanians have received at least one shot.
The purpose of this phased rollout was to target vulnerable populations. Acting Secretary of Health Alison Beam said last week that they were getting reports from many providers that they had unfilled slots on their schedules. Does the state moving into 1B mean they've vaccinated everyone in 1A?
No, I'm certain there are many 1A people who are still unvaccinated. When it comes to people 65 and older, for example, the state estimates that some 700,000 people are unvaccinated in this age group. Now, of course, it's unclear what percent of that group wants the vaccine but is unable to find one.
Secretary Beam attributed this move to an increase in vaccine allotment coming to the state. Do we have any idea about just how much more vaccine the state's getting now than they were getting earlier?
It's hard to say exactly how much supply is increasing because this really fluctuates week to week, but allotments are growing up. What she said is correct there. And if you look at the number of people getting vaccinated daily now compared to mid-January, numbers have roughly tripled.
Are there still some in nursing homes, long-term care facilities still needing vaccines, though?
Yeah, definitely. Regarding nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, when new people come into these facilities, there aren't really good systems to figure out how to get these new residents vaccinated, and that's really risky because these are communal settings.
Sarah, does the issue of vaccine equity become more difficult to achieve as we're adding more eligible people into the mix?
I don't think so, partly because supply is going up, and the reasons that people in, for example, 1A, who have not been vaccinated so far, the same reasons that they still aren't getting vaccinated. Again, like, we need to figure out transportation and technology. And, you know, if people maybe have a hard time hearing or seeing, we need to make accommodations for that.
So as the state moves into 1B this week and 1C next week, and the whole population 16 and older in a couple of weeks, what are some persistent problems that you saw in 1A that you're concerned will continue?
The state said that on April 19th, some 90% of Pennsylvanians will live within 5 miles of a vaccination site. And that's really great. But I want to know, you know, what are the public transportation options to get to these vaccination sites? How many buses do you have to take? How frequently do these buses come? You know, there's so much minutia in these logistics, and it maybe seems unimportant, but if we don't pay attention to these very specific problems, there could be some devastating consequences.
So, Sarah, is there any way to know, to determine just how many people who are eligible now or will be very soon who just don't want the vaccine?
Yeah, that's really hard to say. Some national survey data I would put that number at about 20% of adults who are still very vaccine hesitant or absolutely do not want the COVID vaccine at all. But the good thing is that the number of people who are vaccine hesitant has been going down for months steadily.
And finally, Sarah, is the state or local officials doing anything to address this hesitancy?
The state has always been very adamant that getting vaccinated is, you know, the right decision health-wise. And they do provide information when it comes to questions around safety and efficacy with the vaccine. I know the county health department here in Allegheny County is planning some sort of rollout in the coming weeks when it comes to vaccine hesitancy in public education. But really, I think the most effective messengers are local communities, religious organizations, neighbors, family. You know, ultimately, the reasons people are vaccine hesitant are the same reason that people ultimately get vaccinated. It's because, you know, they want to be safe.
WESA's health and science reporter, Sarah Bowden. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Department of Health visited Shell's Beaver County ethane cracker site in February after being alerted by high COVID activity there. The cracker is the largest construction site in North America and had more than 100 cases in December. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Emails between Department of Health workers obtained through a Right to Know request show the agency was aware of COVID cases at the Shell plant as far back as the summer of 2020. In February, they wrote to Shell to ask for a visit, citing a recent increase in COVID cases there. A Shell spokesman said that three Department of Health officials toured the site on February 26th. They toured medical facilities, office trailers, lunch tents, and work sites. He said the tour was not a compliance audit, and that during and after the visit, company and agency officials shared information on preventing the spread of COVID. Neither Shell nor the Department of Health would say whether the company has made any changes since the visit. Shell's highest caseload was in December, when 106 out of 8,000 workers at the site tested positive. But the company says that number has gone down since. Marissa Baker, an occupational health scientist at the University of Washington, said that suggests the virus is spreading at the site.
There's probably some, you know, evidence of person-to-person spread at work. It's not just all separate people bringing it, you know, into work. It's like, there are people bringing it to work, sure, but then there's also spread at the workplace.
Since the outbreak began, Shell has put several COVID policies into place. The company has an on-site testing lab. It staggered lunchtimes and placed plexiglass dividers at lunch tables, though Baker says those are probably not doing much to prevent the spread of the virus.
It floats all over. It's not blocked by a plexiglass barrier. It easily floats above that, around that. It's really dependent on how the airflow is.
The most effective deterrents, Baker and other experts say, are proper air movement and mask wearing. Shell does have a mask rule, but photos obtained by the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania from a worker on the site show other workers on a bus and in front of a vending machine without masks on. Lee Newman, director for the Center for Health, Work, and Environment at the Colorado School of Public Health, said it's the company's responsibility to enforce mask policies.
We're talking about protective gear that's as important as wearing a hard hat on a construction site right now. A mask is as important. So you know, they can enforce that if they choose to.
The Shell spokesman said the mask mandate is enforced at the site and that noncompliance is infrequent, but is, quote, immediately addressed when observed or reported. Newman said some meatpacking plants have slowed the spread of the disease by implementing paid sick leave policies, which encourage infected workers to stay home.
Taking away that financial pressure is going to be really important. And you can say whatever you want to about, well, you want a tight budget, et cetera. At the end of the day, we're talking about people's lives here.
Ken Broadbent, business manager of Steamfitters Local 449, which has 2,700 members working at Shell, said their contract doesn't include sick leave. That contract was negotiated before COVID-19. But Broadbent says he's skeptical paid sick leave would work at a construction project.
We're always in favor on people, if they're off sick, getting paid. But when you're talking construction, you're talking on bids and it costs money. There's only so much you can do to be practical at times, too.
Broadbent says he supports the changes that Shell has made since the pandemic began and that worker safety appeared to be a priority for the company. He said it isn't just Shell that's having problems with COVID. Other work sites are struggling, too. There are no federal workplace safety standards for COVID, though the Biden administration said it wants to create some soon. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. how we perceive ourselves and how others view us are often at odds. Self-perception, self-determination are at the heart of the award-winning novel Girl, Woman, Other. The author, Bernardine Evaristo, is the first Black woman to win the Booker Prize for Fiction. She'll be giving a talk virtually as part of Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures 10 Evening Series today. Bernardine, welcome to The Confluence.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Your book is a series of hopeful stories of Black women moving forward. How do you mix such a complex issue of self-discovery with a range of emotions, including love and lots of humor?
Well, you know, I guess I've been writing a long time. And so this book has 12 co-protagonists, and they all have equal weight pretty much. And they're aged 19 to 93, and they're all Black women, except one character is non-binary, and they come from, they're of different generations and different cultural backgrounds, they have different sexualities. And in writing the book, I had to dig deep into the characters' lives in order to bring them alive. Mm-hmm. I guess what you then have is you do have this really rich emotional landscape of all these different characters who are all so different from each other, but they kind of, there is a sort of symphony that is created through all their voices being together in this book.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the 12 main characters. I mean, they range from a 93-year-old woman that you alluded to living on a farm in northern England to, I guess we could say, a wearied, maybe discontented teacher. And they're written with these deeply detailed social circles. We don't have time to talk about all 12, unfortunately. The listeners can read about them. I'm going to pick Amma, a lesbian playwright who told her mother she's an apologist for the patriarchy. She left home to be free. Is Amma free throughout her life?
Amma is free in a sense. She has chosen a creative path and she has been free from a lot of society's conventions. I guess she is, in a sense, an expression of a very free and creatively fertile life.
Mm-hmm. She even alludes to commitment to one person is imprisonment.
Yeah, she does. I mean, I'm not like that, but but you know, I guess the task of the writer is to get inside all these lives that are not your own and try and work out what makes them tick.
The motto of her theater company is "On our own terms or not at all." Does that motto resonate throughout her life?
Yes. But she's also paid a price for that when she set up Bushwoman Theatre, which was a Black women's theatre company with her friend Dominique. She wanted to create theatre that was by and about Black women, because that simply wasn't happening in British society in the 1980s. And she's continued with that theme her entire life. And society has now changed. So there is a lot more interest in Black women's creativity. But for a lot of that time, there wasn't a lot of interest. Mm-hmm. So she had her project and she continued on with her project, but she suffered as a result because there wasn't a lot of interest in it. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of money. So she's never had a lot of money in her life, for example, or a lot of attention for her creativity.
Mm-hmm. The book starts on opening night day of her latest work. Has mainstream moved to her, or has she moved more to mainstream?
I think the mainstream's moved to her. We're living in really interesting times, I think, certainly in the UK. And so you have race and you have feminism and you have Black women who suddenly are being looked at in a very different way.
Amma asked of Roland, the father of her daughter. He is a best-selling author. She says, how can you be a professor of modern life when the terms of life are all male? Is that the question you're trying to answer with the entire book, Girl, Woman, Other?
Well, so, you know, that there are lots of multiple points of view in the book, and that each character has their own kind of worldview. And that was also the fun of writing it. And so when Yaz challenges her father, in a sense, she is speaking up for the project of the book, which is to put women, in particular Black British women, Womaxon, because one character is non-binary, at the heart of this society, and to say that these people are interesting and important, and that we just don't have enough stories about Black British Womaxon.
12 protagonists. Is there one you might identify with more than others?
I think they're all fictional, but actually Emma is loosely based on my younger self. So the life she's leading is similar to the life I led, mm-hmm. although the way she is now is not the way I am now. So it's not autobiographical in that way. But I think as the mother of all my children, all my 12 children, I think that I'm attached to them all equally. Although some of them I'm a bit more attached to than others.
You are a very diverse writer, novels, of course, poetry, short stories, essays. What are stories that you like to consume?
Well, I do a lot of reading for work, actually. My sort of favorite writer ever since the 80s has been, it's always come a bit of a cliche, but it has been Toni Morrison. Mm. And I love the depth and breadth and richness of her writing, which is just, you know, so outstanding in every way I can imagine. And every time I re-engage with her stories, I'm moved again and involved again in her work. But I also read a lot of contemporary writers. I recently read The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, which I thought was an incredible novel about twins, and one of them chooses to pass as white and the other one chooses to stay black. I read a lot of fiction by women. I do read a lot of British fiction because I also get asked to blurb books. I don't read enough work in translation, and that's going to be my ambition.
Finally, now's the time when social connections can be more difficult to come by. How do you think you might write about this time that we're in right now?
I have no idea. I don't even know if I will, to be honest, because I think we're many of us are sharing the experience. I mean, you know, obviously some people are suffering more than others, and so on. But there it is a sort of shared experience, especially in countries when we're under lockdown, and you know we can't lead our normal lives and so on. And I just feel that it will probably be done to death in a few years' time. That there will be, you know, lockdown fiction will proliferate. And a lot of the things that I feel and think will probably be written by other people. And I don't want to write what other people are writing. So I'm very unlikely to go there with it. But, you know, who knows? 20 years' time, there may be something that I want to say.
Bernadine Evaristo is an award-winning writer based in the UK. She'll be giving a talk virtually as part of the Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures 10-evening series today. Bernadine, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much indeed.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.